This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is Paul Herrera. Paul is the Government Affairs Director for the Inland Valley Association of Realtors. Paul serves as an advocate for realtors on local issues, helping to preserve and protect property rights and the value of homeownership. His unique experience includes an award-winning journalism career with newspapers in Florida and California, where he covered real estate, small business, the aviation business, and the confluence of government policy, politics, and business. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
We sort of just touched on the affordable housing issue, and so I guess I wanted to talk about that. Is most of the problem in the person that would purchase a property that can't find something affordable, or is it also, does it extend to the rental side where it's just becoming unbearable and somebody has to move out of an area to go to a cheaper area?
I mean, right now there's a problem with affordability across the board. There just aren't enough homes rental or to purchase. You can see the listing numbers when it comes to the ownership side. And on the rental side, you can see the very low vacancy rates across the state and the increasing rents. So those are two very strong indicators of what's going on. If you look around the state, the problem manifests differently. I just spent some time in Sacramento. I'm there fairly regularly. And the number of people who are moving, commuting from Sacramento to San Francisco, San Jose, the Bay Area is incredible. The realtors in the Sacramento area are now showing people from the Bay Area homes on a regular basis. I can't imagine, you know, that kind of scenario.
I don't really know how far that is, a commute.
If there's no traffic, about an hour and 15 minutes.
If
there's no traffic.
Wow.
Now imagine
this is a Rosamond project.
It's close, like, that's almost like here to San Diego, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be here to San Diego, or, I mean, let's say, you know, Beaumont, downtown Los Angeles, every single day.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening right now on a regular basis, that, you know, you have affordability is driving people in different directions. And if they can leave the state, that's happening too. We're definitely seeing that when it comes to middle-class incomes.
So affordable housing ownership would be preferable, because I guess that to me would be a more stable group. If you had somebody get into an entry-level home, they would have equity. They want to stay there. They would, you know, they'd start to being making progress in their own life. So what are some of the ideas that are possible to say, okay, we're going to have to build a different price level home? How do we do that jointly? How do we get the team together to say, all right, it's feasible to do?
That is a very difficult question.
Okay.
In Sacramento. So I guess I'll start with, what would we do if we could actually crack through all the various interests and entrenched groups that are part of the discussion and simply seek a solution? Well, we would find ways to make it profitable to build an entry-level home in California. That's just not possible right now. There is no incentive to buy a piece of land and put up a two-bedroom, two-bath home as you would have two generations ago in Riverside, for instance. Look at the Wood Streets. Look at the mix of working class streets versus larger lots that exist out there. You're not going to find that in newer construction because the costs are way too high. So what do you need to do that? Well, you need to roll back some of the restrictions to entitlements. You have to roll back some of the California Environmental Quality Act when it comes to housing. You know, some level of changes so that you can build and be more confident that when you buy a piece of land and it's properly zoned and it has, you know, and it's the right place to build a home, that you're going to be able to do so without challenges and restrictions.
But it just seems like they're adding. So the California Energy Commission just came out, and after 2020, you're going to have to include solar in all new building projects, regardless of size or price point. And I just feel like, how did that happen off the grid from the affordable housing conversation, like specifically right now?
Well, they start by using the wrong numbers. They start by saying that it would actually improve affordability, which is ridiculous if you actually break down the way people buy houses and the way energy works and the way energy is going to work in the future. But even going away from that, there's this pervasive attitude that we find that people say, well, the median home price in California right now, I think it's about $540,000 or $550,000. What's another $15,000?
Right.
You know, and that seems to be a conversation that people are willing to have when they're setting policy and it's not their money. And they don't necessarily look at what it takes for a young family or individual to get into a home in the first place. And there's been an entire generation of, well, what's another $15,000 if we're buying cleaner air? What's another $15,000 if we're buying, being able to afford the pensions that we're paying or being able to afford this issue or that issue? Some of those things, some of the restrictions are good. There are regulation is important. Some regulation of land use is important. But we've taken it to an extreme. And the way we know that is because we see the amount of cost that comes into California. It doesn't exist in other states, and either even some very good regulatory states.
What's interesting to me about solar, and probably the why I don't have it on my own house, is I think that technology is going to progress pretty quickly, and whatever you put in a year from now, it'd be like a computer, could be completely obsolete in 3 years. There could be a whole different way to do it. And you got this stuff on your roof, and you're like, oh, I don't have to have that now.
Well, Paul and I talked about this last week. One of the frustrating things, and I posted it on Facebook, I don't mind having a conversation about solar, and it's important. I grew up in the Inland Empire in the 80s. I remember third stage smog alerts and coming home feeling like, pins were poking my lungs. Like, I get it. But let's be honest about the data. So utilities are having to change the way that they charge consumers, because everybody assumes like, oh, they're a monopoly, they're just raising rates. Well, no, not really. Solar companies are coming in and taking, the source of income away. You still have to maintain the grid, you still have to maintain connections, and you have to pay for a lot of very expensive pensions. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to start moving towards is a higher fixed cost. So as a consumer, you're going to maybe be paying less in the variable rate of actual usage. So yeah, you're right. Buying solar maybe 10 years ago was a good deal, but in the next 5 years, it could completely change how much it would cost the actual consumer and the affordability of said improvements.
Yeah, the reality is that you're not paying for them to generate electricity. Mm-hmm. You're paying for them to deliver it to your home. You're paying for the wires, infrastructure, that whole setup. That is the vast majority of the cost. So if you have people who are no longer purchasing electricity because they're generating it at home, hey, that's great for them. But they still need the reliability. And so they still, unless they're willing to just unplug from the grid.
Have a battery in the garage, which is possible.
Which is possible. On the other hand, that means that anyone left connected to the grid still has to pay for the grid. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go from, it's hard to imagine we don't go from a system in which we're paying for the amount of energy you use to one in which you're paying to have energy.
And there's also, just to make it even more political, is there's a lot of conversation going solar is sort of the rich man or woman's, option to stick it to government. So it's only affordable to people who can actually pay for the system. And it socioeconomically challenged individuals don't have that option to get off the grid. So it's therefore not equitable.
It's the same concern we have about, raising gasoline costs, raising fossil fuel costs. There's some value to that. You can have a very robust debate about whether we should be changing the mix of ways in which we power our world. However, when you make those changes, you make things more difficult on the working class.
And it's just that you can't do it in a bubble. So that's what was frustrating about that decision a few weeks ago. I'm like, it just wasn't honest. And how can you have the conversation about affordable housing at the same time when you're even not even starting the solar conversation with honest data?
Right.
I think I would be very frustrated if I was sitting in your seat, because we have an event every year at the Nixon Library. I Survive Real Estate. And I always ask the panel, one thing do you want to add? And every year I say the same thing. I would like for every elected official not to act like a Republican or a Democrat, but act like an American. That means both sides would be trying to honestly come to the best solution, not their solution on their side. And I guess in your position, you probably see that constantly. It's just like, dang.
It is the most frustrating part, is to see what is not real evidence. It's essentially facts, or air quote facts, made up to suit an end goal.
Yeah, an agenda. Yeah.
Rather than starting with, let's investigate let's ask the right questions, let's investigate facts,
yeah,
and let's see where that takes us as far as an approach.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen hardly ever.
Yeah, that's very frustrating as an onlooker on a national basis, you know, for politics. And, you know, you're just going, God, we got to get out of our own way somehow. Yeah. On the housing front, back to that, didn't we raise some money or taxing? We added fees for recording documents, and that was directly connected to housing affordability, I think.
Yes,
that's
yes.
where that money was going to go to. When it goes somewhere, what is their plan with that money?
So the 75 we're referring to is a law that we actually supported a couple years ago. It passed, I believe, in the last cycle.
Right.
Which imposes a $75 recording fee on up to three documents. So 225 is the maximum on non-transactional documents. So in other words, if you're buying or selling a house, it doesn't apply there. But if you're refinancing your mortgage or changing your title, then you're paying the $75 fee per document. That money should raise about $300 million statewide annually. We came around to a support position pretty reluctantly, based on a couple of changes. One was that we wanted to make sure the money would be spent where it's supposed to be spent.
That'd be nice.
Affordable housing.
Yeah.
Right? We asked that a quarter of it be spent on ownership housing. So down payment assistance, silent seconds, other vehicles that could help people afford their first home. There is a commission to be part of it that we will be sitting on to help keep oversight of how the money's used. The rest of the funds, rental assistance, Section 8 vouchers,
okay.
A number of other items that help people afford housing. So you break it down into, okay, what programs can we use to help somebody who makes 50% of area median income, let's say $30,000 a year, to afford a place to live? Well, they're not going to buy anything, so you need rental assistance. What can you do for people making 120% of area median income? Well, now you get into the ownership side or maybe some supplemental assistance depending on family size. So that's where the money is designed to go.
Okay.
And we hope it will.
Okay. The new thing about you have a single family home and now you can maybe have not another residence, but a granny flat
right.
in the back. Is that across the board in California or is that isolated to certain counties?
It's been we've been advancing several stages of state law to help make that easier. We actually have a bill in the current legislature, although it seems to be stalling at the moment, which would really reduce some of the cost of building those units, what we call accessory dwelling units, ADUs. So over the past couple of years, we've made it increasingly difficult for local governments to deny permits for the construction of ADUs. In this bill we're doing this year, we would also make it illegal to impose impact fees, school fees, water fees, as if you were building a new home.
Ah.
So now you wouldn't have any of those attached.
Okay.
As long as you're building an ADU. We also would attach some penalties or some changes so that you couldn't just sit on an application. So after 60 days, the permit's considered approved if the local government has not taken action on it, for instance.
How many days?
60.
Wow, that is nice.
Right. So we want them to act on it, not just let it sit on the counter and never give a response to the person asking, you know, to build this. And there's a number of other items that are in there to really restrict what local governments can do when it comes to denying permits for accessory dwelling units. This is, if you look at older parts of San Diego County, San Diego City, Los Angeles, you'll see these everywhere. You'll see where people have converted garages, converted
Sure.
parts of their homes. And it's something that we can't deny is going on. What we want to do is take it out of the shadows and bring it to have these things inspected,
intentionally
built correctly,
built. Yeah.
Know that they exist, and do them in a proper way. Because you can't change the economic dynamics that cause people to say, you know what, I want to bring my grandparents to my home or my kids need a place to live and a little bit of privacy or just plain, I can't afford this home if I can't have another renter in this home.
I was going to ask that. Is there any limitation on it? Renting it out, is that one of the things? So you wouldn't be able to, because I'm sure we'll get into it, vacation rental thing. Right. Is there any stipulation on the things you're working on to limit what that would look like, whether it's a short-term rental, long-term rental, family rental?
We're not seeking any of those limitations on an ADU. It's the theory of the case is we want more building, more places where people can live. And if this is something that helps alleviate supply crunch, given the fact that we're not inventing new land out there, for the most part, we're not entitling new vast swaths of land, especially in the urban cores of the Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Orange County, then this opens up a little bit of development opportunity. And again, it's a little bit. It's not something that you're not suddenly going to double the number of available homes. Not everyone's going to do this. A lot of people don't want to. Some lots are just not built for it. And we can't overcome lot sizes. We can't overcome certain parts of the law. And some building codes have to be adhered to.
Let's just talk briefly about the PACE program.
Sure.
Okay. First of all, basically, what is it?
PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's a program that for participating cities allows homeowners to finance energy efficient improvements. This could be anything from solar panels, solar energy systems, to insulation, to dual pane windows. There's all a huge list of items. Now you can do water efficiency improvements such as drought tolerant landscaping. And you do that with financing that is paid back through your property tax bill. You take out a loan and you pay it back through your property taxes.
Now, from a lender's point of view, and this is, you know, let's say we have lent somebody money on a first trust deed. Mm-hmm. They're rehabbing the property and they say, you know what, I'm gonna use the PACE program for some energy efficient improvements that I don't want to pay out of the pocket. Right. So that bill, let's say it's $30,000, all of a sudden becomes senior to my loan.
Yes.
Has there been any discussion about the concern of that? Because this is what's happening. Let's say now he goes and tries to resell it. Fannie Mae looks at it and says, well, you know, that's really two loans on the property, not one. How does Fannie Mae deal with that? They just say no to the loan?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
They deny it.
Right.
There's been a lot of discussion about the seniority because of the fact that this financing goes in the property tax bill. It means that it supersedes everything, including your that first mortgage.
But it's done after the fact. Too.
It's done after the fact. Now, if you actually look at the contracts that borrowers sign with their lenders, the loan could be called technical default. That's true of FHA mortgages. That's true of anything backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It hasn't happened yet. And it probably wouldn't happen, but that is possible because you're not allowed to voluntarily place anything else ahead of your first mortgage.
Not only that, you have no control over the size. You don't even know that it's happened unless you're checking the property tax to see that it's gone up.
Correct.
So in no way, shape, or form any of these PACE lender programs going back to the original note holder and saying, hey, by the way, this is about to happen. Might be $15,000, might be $65,000, don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's an exception to that, and that is on commercial property. If you use PACE on commercial property, the PACE companies have to get permission, or actually the owner has to get permission from the lender to place the PACE assessment on it.
Why not residential?
Because they would say no.
Okay. Well, okay. You know, that's when you kind of get concerned about agendas, because it does put somebody in good faith to put up money at risk that they didn't know they were adopting.
Right.
The other thing is there's a lot of rules now. We can't make anybody a loan that's an owner occupant, because it's just the rules are so restrictive. So if somebody that's say 80 years old comes in with a free and clear house and they want to borrow $20,000 on a $400,000 house, I have to say no to that. But they can borrow up to 80% of their house value on the PACE program.
No, they're limited to 15%, but they can take of their current value of the property.
Okay, that's
now,
good to know.
They can take the cumulative loan of value, so if they have an existing mortgage on it, they can take that to 97.5%.
Okay, so they can take it right up to the hill. But right. I guess there's different rules for qualifying in that program than any other loan program. Because the want of getting the green improvements is right. Superior.
So when it started, now we've made some significant reforms to PACE.
Okay.
And we actually feel that by the end of this year, we may be in a position to no longer have an opposition to the PACE program. The changes that we made, everything but the lien superiority. So the way we're trying to address that is we feel that it can be done through disclosure and through a full understanding. So if somebody borrows money through a PACE program and knows from day one that they're going to have to pay this off when they sell their house, and there's no expectation set in any other direction, then we think it's manageable. We also want to make sure that there's more underwriting. So initially there was no underwriting. You know, do you own this house? Yes. Are you current your payments? Yes. Did you pay your tax bill last year? Yes. Sign here. You have a loan.
Mm-hmm.
We know from pretty good experience in recent past that you need to do a little more than that. So the new laws that are in effect actually right now, as of this year and will be enforced as of next year, there was a question about why there's two things are different. But the new laws now look at income, ability to repay, do they have the funds to afford the higher bill?
Okay.
And there's a number of other items, incentives that have in the past been provided to contractors and to others. Those are being done away with so that now it's going to be much more akin to a traditional lending program, with the exception of the senior lien.
If they believe in it so much, I just don't understand why they don't go into second place. And it's a higher percentage rate than what the first is always going to offer typically.
The higher percentage rate, I can't fully explain other than there's bond market dynamics that I don't understand. But the fact that it is in a senior position is essentially a bond market issue. If they didn't do that,
They wouldn't have a program.
It would just about, especially the way it was initially done without underwriting, it would be an unsecured loan in just about every sense at that point.
Mm-hmm. We've only got a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you'd like to maybe talk about that I haven't asked about? Is there any topic you go, okay, this is important?
You know, what's going to be critical, I think, in this is an election year. And people are going to make some decisions based on all kinds of priorities. But we really want people to take a look at how elected officials are addressing housing. Because it is now a big enough topic in California that everybody's being asked to answer for that and how they think that Californians are going to be able to afford homes in the future. There's nothing we can do today that's going to help deal with the housing affordability problem in 2020 or 2021. We're talking about what kind of housing market we're going to have in 2025 and 2030 and 2040. And that's what we can chip away at here. So when people are looking at the answers that that they're hearing from elected officials, they should look at what answers they're providing on housing questions, whether they sound realistic, whether they feel it makes a difference, and whether that's the way that they feel they want to go. Without engagement, we don't make changes.
Okay. I guess, you know, where the money comes from is everybody's concern. Is there any budget crisis? You know, we hear about cities having issues with retirement programs and all that. Is that something that's imminent for the Inland Empire?
Yes. By imminent, we mean within a five-year horizon.
Right.
You're looking at, well, let me give you one example. Riverside County, it's a big one. Riverside County's budget is in very serious trouble at the moment, and it's growing year by year. Every year that we don't really address it means that the pain becomes worse.
Correct.
And in my discussions with county leadership, they've been pretty clear that in about 5 or 6 years, they don't have a way to fix the budget gap. Even there are no cuts that are possible to get there. So at some point, we got to start looking at possible tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lake Elsinore, about a decade ago, began an informal policy that every new development comes with a new taxing district. So everything comes with what's called a community facilities district. And that's how they pay for the increased costs of firefighting and law enforcement and road paving. Actually, the communities are usually responsible for their own infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of concept is being discussed across the county and across the Inland Empire and across California.
Which will make homes even less affordable.
Correct.
Yeah.
That every home is going to have an additional, you know, $2,000 a year or $500 a year, whatever that number might be, that is essentially there to cover the cost of government. Which is to say that the current taxing levels aren't sufficient to fill those gaps,
or the promises were just too big in the first place.
And that's the biggest issue. If we're not, people look at taxation and say, "Well, I'm being taxed too much," and they don't want to look at the front end of that, which is we're spending too much, or
right. We're
not making the right decisions, we're not forcing the right decisions. And you know, if you're not dealing with the spending, you're not dealing with the taxing.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really do appreciate what you do for our industry, too. Really
do. Of course. Thank you, Bruce.
Hey, this is Aaron Norris. We would love to see you out and about town at different events all across California. If you are a member of the Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, you can catch me on June 7th at the SRCAR Realtor Expo. They always sell out, and it's going to be in Temecula. Hope to see you there. June 7th, that same day, if you are in the Ontario area, the Appraisal Institute is having their 21st annual Inland Empire Market Update, and we'll see you there. And then later that same evening, we'll be doing Stay Put or Cash Out at the San Diego Investment Club. June 19th, the Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association is having their 14th annual anniversary dinner party. If you want to go and receive a discount, you better sign up soon. It's always a great night. Bruce and I will be on panel together being interviewed by Eric Saragusa with questions that they've sourced from their membership and their board. Always a really fun night. So check that out. Go to thenorrisgroup.com, get the training tab to see all of our upcoming events.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.